People talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and fought and dying. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, what's more in news and views for our people? Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, today, the 13th of February, is the 74th anniversary of a horrible war crime committed by the Allies, particularly, especially the British, and with an assist from the Americans. And that was the genocidal bombing of the German city of Dresden. And this is a show I did yesterday with Brian Rue, which explains the entire thing about this, about Dresden. So this is Paul Fromm, and the...
Welcome to Brian Rue's show. It's February the 12th, 2019. Tomorrow's the anniversary of the Dresden bombing in Germany back in 1945. And my guest is Paul Fromm in Hamilton, Ontario. So welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's both good and sad to be here. Good to be on your show as always, but sad because of what we have to talk about tonight, today.
Yeah, let's talk about Dresden. It's somewhere between like 250 to 600,000 German men and women, children were burned. Many like burnt whole and alive, which like the definition of a Holocaust.
Yeah, that really was a Holocaust. A Holocaust is a term out of the Bible, meaning a burnt offering.
Yeah.
And probably between 300,000 and 500,000 civilians were a burned offering. Incinerated in most cases for the insane vanity of Winston Churchill, who had just a psychopathic hatred of the German people. I think we have to be very clear that this was not exactly a special case, but let's say the worst type of cases. All European nations bound themselves by the Geneva Conventions, and one of the rules of war is not to target civilians. That doesn't mean that in the normal course of war, civilians might not be hurt, that they can be collateral damage. Let's say if you're bombing a factory and there's some working class homes in the neighborhood, some might be the victims of an accidental bomb falling upon them, or a fire started at the factory, burns their house down, and so on. But the idea was not to target civilians. The British, and later on joined by the Americans, deliberately targeted German cities, particularly the civilian population. The idea was to break the will of the people. Hamburg was made into a giant, not to be funny about it, hamburger on several bombing raids, but several thousand planes would drop bombs with the intent of destroying people's houses and hopefully killing a lot of people. Over 600,000 German civilians died in some of these bombings. But Dresden, even given that, was special and especially bad. It occurred on February the 13th and over the next 2 days, February the 13th, 1945. The war was lost for National Socialist Germany. There was no doubt about it. The war was essentially over, except for the final Allied invasion from the east with Russia and from the west, but the British, Americans, and Canadians, etc., to actually occupy Germany. So on the 13th of February, 1945, the British, along with the Americans, but essentially the British, sent over 1,000 bombers in successive waves over Dresden. Now, Dresden had no military value. It was not a manufacturing city. It was not a military command. It had no strategic value. It should never have been bombed under the rules of war. What I'm about to explain is in every sense of the word a war crime. And if the Nuremberg trials had in fact been about justice, rather than simply victor's benches, in the dock would have been Winston Churchill.
Yeah, absolutely. What a war criminal. He's in hell now, that's for sure.
Air Force Chief, Air Vice Marshal Bomber, his nickname was Bomber Harris, and others in the British and American high command. Dresden was an old cultural and university city. You've heard of Dresden, China. It was long been a cultural center with some beautiful architecture, including something that was called the Virgin's Church or the Frauenkirche. It was a beautiful city, and it had not been bombed before, and it was targeted simply to massacre a large number of civilians. This would in no way hasten the end of the war, but it would hasten. It would end probably between 300,000 and 500,000 human lives. To add to the mess is that the Soviet army, the communists, were only about 70 miles away from Dresden to the east. And so Dresden had become a large catchment area for refugees, for Germans fleeing the advancing Soviet armies. So that was the situation on the night of February 13, 1945. The first wave of Allied bombers dropped percussion bombs. And the idea was to wreck as much as they could, but particularly to blow the roofs off houses. The next wave of bombers, after that wave was over, many people thought, well that's it. And so rescue teams rushed in from towns and cities as much as 50 or 60 miles away. They rushed in, and then came the next wave. And these planes carried incendiary bombs, that is, kaboom. And these bombs fell, and in many cases, they could penetrate right down into a house. They wouldn't bounce off the roof. They'd go right down into the already destroyed roof and just incinerate the house. The agony caused by these bombs was incalculable. The heat melted the pavement. The heat created a giant firestorm that sucked most of the oxygen out of the air in many parts of Dresden. So whether you were underground, like in a basement, or hiding in a park, as many people did, thinking, well, they wouldn't bomb the park. The conditions were incredible. There was a firestorm that incinerated tens of thousands more. There was more bombing. And then when dawn came the next day, they sent in fighter planes. And some of the people who had struggled their way to the Elbe River, which runs through Dresden, were machine gunned. There are cases of planes going through the zoo, machine gunning animals, machine gunning people. This was an out and out massacre of civilians. That is a war crime in anybody's book.
Yeah.
And it was mandated from the top by Winston Churchill. And there were people in the British High Command that had a lot of problems with that. That said, well, in British terminology, that's just not sporting. And it isn't. It isn't.
So did Churchill give the order? Like, people were against him. He said, no, I want to do this. And he actually.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was discussion, and there were voices raised against it. But, Churchill, it was a direct order from Churchill, and he wanted, he said he wanted maximum death. Murder and brutality, plain and simple. This wasn't blowing up the other guy's bridge or blowing up a tank on a battlefield or shooting down the other guy's airplanes, which would be fair play in battle. This was the deliberate massacring of civilians en masse, and many of them died by being basically reduced to mush.
Someone just melted, like the human tissue just melted on the floor of the basement of the houses.
Yes, I read accounts where rescuers would go into a basement and they could hardly believe what they saw. All that was left, there might be a few, it might be a hat or a shoe, and just puddles of, well, something fat, really, just liquid. It had been that bad. This is something that we go back over World War II. Could you excuse me 1 second?
And they also took a break in the bombing. There was the first wave of bombing, then there was a break so that rescue crews could come in from other parts of Germany. So they deliberately waited for all these rescue crews to come in, these specialists. And then they planned this so that in the second wave of bombing, they could kill those as well. So they premeditated this in the most underhanded way to kill even more people. Because people thought it was over after the first wave. Okay, the bombing's over now. So then people would come into to Dresden to help with all the dead and wounded. So they deliberately waited for them to come. And then the next wave of bombing came on.
Yeah, sorry about that. I think we have to be very, very clear. Dresden was not a military target. It was basically a cultural center. So in addition to all the other damage, irreplaceable cultural and architectural treasures were destroyed. And it was entirely civilians. And with the added sadism that the next day, the fighter planes were sent in to strafe the survivors who were in the Elbe River or near on the banks of the Elbe. And don't forget, it's February, so it's cold. That has to be hung forever on the Allies and on Winston Churchill. And, you know, I think one of the things that we in the revisionist movement are trying to do is, in terms of history, take a second look. That doesn't mean that everything we've learned about anything is all false, of course not. But definitely the account of World War II, certainly in the West, has been, this was the good war. Other wars may have been vainglorious or stupid or maybe even wrong, but this was the good war because we fought evil. We cooperated with evil. Pouring in from the East were the barbarians of the Soviet army who would rake their way across much of Eastern, what was once Germany. Not everyone. There were decent Russian soldiers, and there were many not decent Allied soldiers. The Americans came to France supposedly as liberators. The only people who thought of them as liberators were the communists in the Résistance. They thought that they could have their way free and clear with French women, that every French woman was a slut. And the Americans were notorious. Again, not all of them, of course. But the German army would never have done that under National Socialism because the German army was strictly disciplined. Soldiers caught stealing, soldiers caught raping, in the odd case, would be severely punished or in some cases executed. It would not be tolerated to go in and rape the civilian population. But there's one other interesting thing. Anybody who's ever read any of the literature about World War II has probably seen a picture of bodies that look like stacked cordwood. And, you know, we're very vulnerable when we look at pictures. You've got a statue behind you on the windowsill.
Yeah, but...
But if I didn't know that, I have to rely on you to tell me what it is. I mean, somebody else might say, no, that's a dancing girl from Thailand. What do I know?
Yeah, that is the Buddha. So, there we go.
There's the Buddha. But we know that. Well, I guess it's a famous statue, but we know that because you're an authority and you tell us. Well, that picture of the bodies in stacked cordwood is very often identified as bodies from Auschwitz. You see, these are... cremated. Well, they can't be cremated Jews, can they? Because they're bodies. But anyway, they're gas Jews or something. Very often you'll see that picture miscaptioned. The picture's a true picture, but it's not Auschwitz or some detention camp. It was the charred bodies, or a few of the charred bodies from Dresden. A number of us are commemorating this sad event tomorrow. A local Toronto group called the Association of German Expellees. These are people, Germans who were ethnically cleansed, there were 16 million of them, from their homes in the East, from places like Ostpreussen or East Prussia, from Pomerania, from Memel, from the Sudetenland, from Silesia, from places that are now in the Ukraine, and from what's called the lands of the Donau-Schwabens, or the Danube-Schwabians, which would be now, well, what used to be northern Yugoslavia and western Romania. So there are many of these people still alive in Toronto, and for at least the last 10 years, on or around the 13th of February, they and other people like myself get together and commemorate this. And it's important to keep the memory alive, and it's important to keep it up there on the discussion board. Because we get an extremely one-sided view of World War II. Not just one-sided, fair enough, every country's going to tell its story from its point of view, but we get an incredible crock of lies, information that's just suppressed. Although many people probably have heard of Dresden, they'd say, well, that's a pretty big bombing raid. And some may know a little bit more about it and say, well, why was it a civilian target? It wasn't even military. Why would they do it when the war is basically over? Yeah, but the truth really is even worse than that, and that is the full measure of it. the collaborationist present German government doesn't like to talk about Dresden.
Yeah, there's something hidden, right? I know David Irving told a story, like he wrote his first book about it when he was a young man in 1963. He was working in Germany, and the Germans were telling him, but he never heard of Dresden. So Dresden was something largely suppressed. I think officially they say only 25,000 died.
That's right.
They try to bury the history, just as they manufacture fake history.
I mean, even though, I mean, 25,000 is a pretty big figure, but yes, it's being suppressed. The official German government doesn't want to talk about it. Well, we know why. Because any decent patriotic nationalist in government would ask for reparations, or would ask at least for an apology.
Public apology, yeah.
We apology care about Germany. But the only people who are supposed to apologize for World War II are the Germans.
Yeah.
We have paid, I'm told, billions of dollars to survivors, and they still are. Survivors, hardly anybody who was alive in 1945 is alive today, very, very few. How can there be so many survivors? That's another question. The Japanese absolutely refuse. They will not pay reparations. They have made a few very vague apologies, like that, you know, they're sorry, war brings suffering to many people, and they regret sufferings that they might have inflicted. But it has not been the groveling, soul-destroying, wallet-empty 74 years that have gone on. I mean, this is extraordinary. And there were, I think any objective view of World War II would say there were many people who committed terrible things, crimes or war crimes. I mean, way beyond deaths on the battlefield. Yes, of course, that's always sad, but that's war. But the targeting of civilians, the murder of civilians, and I used to believe that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was probably justified. That yes, it was a tremendous loss of life, but it was one short, sharp, agonizing pain, and Japan would recognize it. It could not win the war. They would have to surrender.
I used to think that too, yeah. So
yeah,
to surrender.
And I believe that in all good faith. I began to learn more, though. One thing I learned is that Japan was already essentially about to surrender. Like, bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki didn't save lives. I used to think it would, because I'd been told that they fought ferociously to defend that. Okinawa and so on, they would fight even more ferociously to defend every square inch of the home Japanese islands. But essentially, the Japanese rulers, the military, had decided they had lost. That they would have to try to survive as best they could and make the best possible loser's deal with the Americans, which is what happened. The frying of the civilian population in Hiroshima and Nagasaki was gratuitous and over the top. Neither, of course, was a military target. And very interestingly, and you know, you can kind of muddle over this, why did they choose those cities? Well, why not Tokyo?
Because they're a large Christian population there. The perpetrator is very deep hatred for Christian culture, perhaps.
Isn't that amazing? Because that the two cities, particularly Nagasaki, where there was a substantial Christian population in an overwhelmingly Buddhist and Shinto society, were the cities they chose to bomb. You might say, at least spiritually, if you're a Westerner, our people. It'd be like trying to make a point, about Italy, and you decide, well, we're going to take out Rome in the Vatican.
Well, yeah, the Americans don't have a deep hatred for Christians, so I wonder who in the decision-making process has this very deep hatred for Christians then.
Well, I guess we'd have to look more closely at who was advising Roosevelt. But there were people close to him who subscribed to the mad...
Truman, that's where Roosevelt had died. There's Truman who dropped
the bomb. You're right. Yeah, you're right. But there were people around him who subscribed to the Germany Must Perish, a madman thesis put out in the book by Frederick Hoffman.
Yeah. Theodore Hoffman, I think, right?
Yeah, sure, right. Theodore Hoffman.
Theodore Hoffman, yeah.
Oh, they all sound
strongly motivated to Germany Must Perish.
Yeah. And that was, of course, a book that kind of, in a sense, touched Canada. It was one of the books that was the subject of the hate law trial of Arthur Topham a couple of years ago. And what he did was he wrote a parody of the first couple of paragraphs, and even on the cover, and where it said Germany and Germans, he put Israel and Jews. And that was deemed to be hate propaganda. Because the jury didn't have to specify, we don't know which of the about half dozen different titles of books that were discussed at the trial and were alleged to be hate, they found to be hateful. They don't have, Arthur was not charged with several counts. It was just one count, but the evidence were these various things. Well, were there some of these books they did not find hate? Others they did, we don't know. In the air, among some of the Allies, was this idea that they would not simply win the war against National Socialist Germany, but that the German people must be destroyed. Now, some people say, well, Kaufmann was just an extremist and wasn't taken seriously. Yeah. No, that's not true. And we know that after the war, when Germany had surrendered, again, the normal Geneva Conventions would be protect and try to give some assistance to the civilian population, and you capture and demobilize the enemy armed forces. What the Allies did, or they did that in some cases. Took the captured German soldiers, took away their weapons, processed them, and then released them. But Eisenhower, probably unbeknownst to many of the others, had a little over a million German soldiers interned in open fields along the Rhine. And these soldiers were deliberately starved to death. They were deprived of almost all food. There were almost no facilities, no medicine, and even relatively healthy men began to get weak and sickened. Disease spread. Civilians who tried to throw bread or other foodstuffs over the barbed wire were threatened with being shot, and in some cases were shot.
Well, was actual cases of them getting shot trying to help the Germans and stuff?
Yes, so I assure you, there was a Canadian writer who's still alive, James Back, who blew the whistle on this about 30 years ago in a book called Other Losses.
I can't see you. Is your... Oh, yeah, now I see you. There you go.
This was an incredible war crime. And then there was a massive relief fund created to bring food to the hugely displaced population of Germany. And the infrastructure being terribly damaged by the bombing, by some fighting. Then there was this influx of millions of refugees. Back then they called them DPs, or displaced persons. And still the Germans managed to manage, but the food for months did not arrive. And it did not arrive because it was deliberately stopped by senior members of the American Army.
Is that for the displaced persons or for the...
The food was for Germany, for people, for everybody who was there.
Oh.
And finally, a brave United States Senator from North Dakota and former President Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover had a major responsibility in organizing the food relief, protested publicly, and within about 9 months or a little while after that, after the war, the food was beginning to get through. However, a million German civilians perished because of starvation, needless starvation, after the end of the war. Now, these are real war crimes. And unfortunately, if you ask, the average miseducated, I won't say uneducated, miseducated or propagandized graduate of our education system, well, what was the war crimes committed in World War II? Well, even the dumbest of the dumb would, 6 million Jews. Right. Actually, wrong. the way Hollywood has told us about it, it didn't happen. But other things did happen.
Yeah, I'm wondering these million, Mike. I think a million of these, disarmed enemy combatant German soldiers, about a million of them were starved to death. Yeah, on top of them, how many of the civilians, of the 60 million? Yeah, I guess a couple of million of them perished on the way. So one
of the 16 million expellees, about 3 million perished.
Wow.
Many were murdered, others starved or froze to death.
Yeah.
And to add to the misery, the winter of 1944-45 was one of the worst in decades. Bitterly cold, snow, everything that would make a hasty journey with just a few, what you could carry or put on a cart, even more miserable. And, it was mostly old men, young children, and women who were fleeing.
Yeah, that's misery.
And these stories are, let me put it this way, very much underpublicized. And that's one of the things that the Association of German Expellees has tried to do. If you don't get the whole picture, you draw wrong conclusions.
Yeah.
Like, we both know friends who've gone through bitter romantic breakups. If you hear only one side, you may not know the full picture, because one side, has its own view, or maybe lying to you. The other side has to be heard. But in war, we have heard basically, at least in Canada and the United States, we've heard basically. After the war, there were some true stories about bravery. Airmen and soldiers who escaped German POW camps. Love to a movie like The Great Escape and so on, Colditz Castle. So that type of story, which would be essentially mostly true. And we got battle stories like The Longest Day and Normandy and so on, which more or less accurately reflect the battlefield tactics and what happened. But in terms of human suffering beyond the battlefield, we have heard almost exclusively only the tales from one group of people, the Jews, who have told us the incredible suffering and if you display any skepticism and wonder, is that exactly that way? Well, yes, you mustn't ask the questions like that, but you begin to find the story doesn't hold, the stories don't hold water. And Alison Chabot did an amazing satirical song called Survivors. And she tears apart, I think it's three of the best known survivors and their tales. And it wouldn't survive, these stories wouldn't survive cross-examination even from the dullest country lawyer. one of her best is a woman named Irene Sisplat, who, 30 years after the war.
Yeah, she explained how her skin was being assessed for lampshades, because she was a young girl, about 15, and she had really clear white skin. So they were measuring up for lampshades, and she told a story where she was pushed into a gas chamber, but it was too crowded, it was too full, so the guard opened the door and she flung her out, so somehow she survived. So people can look her up, Irene Sisplat. So Alex Shabazz did some satirical songs on this, so. And they don't like satire.
If you're telling a lie or stretching the truth, when somebody satirizes you, you know, they know that you're full of it. For instance, Irene Sisplat, in her book, among other things, says that she was given the family fortune, which was in diamonds. Now, why they would give it to a teenage girl, Donna Lee was, okay, let's go with the story. And she said, well, she had to hide the diamonds. Okay, that makes sense if she had diamonds. So according to her, she would swallow them every night and excrete them the next day and do it again. Well, just think for a moment. Well, how would you go to the bathroom in such a way that you can retrieve the diamonds?
Yeah, she'd have to go through it and retrieve the diamonds along the way.
How do you beat them all? I mean, the story. You know, come on, make up a better way.
It shows their suffering, right? It shows how much they suffer going through all this shit.
Yeah, exactly. The thing, though, is we're supposed to be like just dummies. If this is a religion, and, you know, when the priest or the preacher or whoever he is tells you, and God says, you're not supposed to be a smart aleck. I said, well, how do I know God said that? How did you know God said that? Did he talk to you? Did he phone you up this morning? You know, a lot of what goes on in religion doesn't bear careful examination. You have to have a faith. Okay, but we're not being told about a religious faith. We're told about something that allegedly happened. But it beggars the imagination. Well, when Allison was on trial, one of the witnesses against her was a fellow named Gideon Felcher, who's the head of the CAA, that's the Committee Against Anti-Semitism, which is very, very powerful, very well connected, and has done incredible damage to the free speech movement in England. And he was asked about that by Adrian Davis, who's Allison's lawyer. And he said, he hadn't read the book. Well, he was asked, well, how do you know that Allison is not right in her critique of the book? It's true. Irene Sisplat may have exaggerated some things. Yeah, like quite a bit. You and I might say it might be a better way to hide the diamonds. Might be, oh, I don't know, dig a little hole beside your bed or hide them in an old piece of wood or anything, but the story wasn't very dramatic, and you'd say, oh my God, the poor woman, imagine going through her own shit the next day. We have really been put upon. And you know, there's several ways of going at a reassessment of World War II, but one is to hear the stories of other people. We've heard the stories of the of Jews until, you know, we're sick of them. What about other people? And that's one of the things it's one of the points of the Dresden Memorial. And, you know, there still will be people, I think mostly very old people, but who will say, well, the Germans deserved it. That's because of what they did to the Jews. Well, the individual, you know, no matter what happened to the Jews, and it certainly wasn't the tale we've been told, but I don't doubt some Jews died. I don't doubt some Jews were murdered. I don't doubt Jews were unpopular with many Germans, and even with many people further east, in places like Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Estonia, where they had collaborated with the communists, and the communists and some of the Jewish allies had done some terrible things. Yeah, there was a lot of resentment, and the Jews were a very popular people. Whatever happened to them would not justify the massacring of civilians. I mean, that was one of the understandings of the Geneva Conventions, that yes, soldiers will kill each other, wound each other, and maim each other, and that's not a good thing, but that's what war is. But you don't deliberately go after civilians.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the bombing of Dresden was.
Well, I mentioned that we've got some comments in our live chat here. I just wanted to maybe read some.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So live chat, James Thomas said, most of the Soviet troops were non-Asiatic types from Siberia and Central Asia, mostly Kazakhs Uzbeks, Mongolians, Tatars, Buryats, Yakuts, Tajiks, Tuvans, etc. It also says, thank you, Brian and Paul, for reminding us of the atrocities that our people suffered at the hands of our enemies. Let's see, further down here, Blitz77 says, God bless Paul Fromm. There we go. Yes, we got about 30 people here in the chat.
That's really good. And you know, people are always, I think, sometimes feeling frustrated. You know, what can I do or what can we do? Well, there are many things we can do. Even just talking about this, putting this out there, that these things happen. And that is one of the things that so encourages me about the internet. These stories about our people are getting out there that have been suppressed or downplayed for almost 75 years. You know, I'd like to ask the question, when was the last movie or docudrama you saw about the fate of the 16 million German expellees? Well, what was the first one you saw? unless you speak German, you probably have never seen a dramatic movie about that. And there was a movie made a few years ago about that. And there have been a few docudramas. But while everybody's heard of the 6 million, virtually nobody's heard of the 16 million.
Yeah, good point.
3 million who died. It just goes to show the fact that we've been very badly served by our intellectuals. But historians know this is not a quick way to tenure or a quick way to become department head to write anything but the World War II, the Hollywood version of World War II. Not a career-enhancing move. That's why some of the best writing, though not the only writing, has come from very learned people who are not academics, like David Irving or Alfred Desaias. You might be interested, listeners might want to Google his name, that two-word, second word, Desaias, Z-A-Y-A-S. And Alfred Desaias was a lawyer. He did a lot of work with various United Nations agencies, and he became interested in the issue of the expellees about 25 years ago, and he put out several books about it, and they are available. And he's done a tremendous job, but he too is he's not a university professor, but he's very well educated. And these are stories I think we have to tell to help overcome the guilt industry that's associated with the Holocaust. The Holocaust story is a religion rather than a historical account. And it's a religion for us. And it's a religion to make us feel guilty and easily controlled. Because no matter what the issue is, we can always hear the slogan, remember the Holocaust. I mean, I've heard that in terms of our immigration arguments. Remember the Holocaust.
Yeah, and I was doing an industry video on Saturday, asking people, what do you think of Adolf Hitler? This young man, he was listening to me, we were talking at quite a bit of length, and then I told him that the Holocaust was a hoax, and he said, well, thank you very much, I have to go. And then he just ended the conversation. You can see right on the video that he just reacted because he was programmed to react that way. Because that's like the highest ethical issue of our age. You know, it's the most sinful thing to deny that.
Yeah, you know, we have been really put upon. I like to look at different ways to approach this. But one way is, look, it's another tribe's history. Not my tribe. I'm a European or a Canadian of European origin. It's not my tribe. Now, I'm quite happy to have any tribe say anything it wants among itself as its own history. And they will celebrate certain victories and certain battles and certain sufferings and so on that is meaningful or meaningful to the tribe. And they need not all this be exactly numerically accurate. But as long as it's just what they talk about among themselves that they believe, I have no problem with it. I believe any old thing they want. Where I do have a problem is when I'm told I have to believe it, and more than that, I have to adopt it. One thing I throw out there for the people that are listening is this. One way to handle this might be to say, okay, as a North American, a Canadian or American, let me see, this Holocaust story. I think you'll agree that whatever it was, we, in Canada or the United States, didn't do it. We didn't do it. It didn't happen on our territory, so we're not responsible. It didn't happen to our people. And from what I understand, we fought the guys who allegedly did do it. So don't
blame the good guys, right?
Don't blame this Holocaust shit on me. We're the good guys. And I don't want to, your stories don't interest me. They bore me. They're not my tribe. I'm not interested. And you know, a man who in his own way came fairly close to saying this was the great French patriotic leader of Front National, Jean-Marie Le Pen. I met Jean-Marie, and several years ago, he said, and he repeated this, that the Holocaust, he says, was a détail of history. What was he saying? What does détail mean? You know, it's like he was saying like a mere detail. It's not the only thing he was saying. It's not, you know, there are other people who suffer. There are other issues. France was involved. The various things happened to France and so on. And he was, I think it was a way of saying, I'm not interested. What was the best made fire machine gun in the Soviet Army? I don't know. Frankly, I don't care. Maybe military historians might, but it's a detail that doesn't interest me. And I think that is perhaps the right attitude. It doesn't interest me. You can believe whatever you like, but. I'm not going to believe it because I think it's nonsense. And even if it isn't nonsense, it doesn't mean anything to me. And maybe that's a good headspace to be in because we've got to develop a lot more solidarity for our own people.
That's right. Another comment I'll read here from Red Phil Bulgari says, this is why they're putting laws in place that can't even question the event. If we manage to deconstruct this lie, the whole system will collapse as a sandcastle.
Yeah, and maybe when people realize they've been duped, that they've been put upon, it isn't just that somebody told you a wild story that I was a veteran and I single-handedly charged a machine gun nest. I'd be wounded in five places by one hand would no longer work, but with my teeth, I pulled out the pin with my last bit of strength. I tossed a grenade in and saved all my money. Okay, probably laying it on a bit thick, but it doesn't matter, really. He's not trying to make me feel guilty. He's not trying to control me. He's entitled to his beer sodden memory. No real harm done. But this Holocaust thing has been used to control us and to guilt us. And you were at Monica Schaefer's talks in Vancouver, and one of the things she pointed out is that it's so bad in Germany now. Not only is it illegal to deny the Holocaust, whatever that means, means questioning details of World War II. But if you're on trial, you cannot defend yourself by saying, well, no, the reason I said this is that, let's say, the Leica report found that those structures that were told were gas chambers couldn't possibly have been used for those purposes. Oh, that's another crime. Yeah, that's reoffending. So it would be extremely hard to defend yourself. I was wondering, as a person with a fair knowledge of the legal system, exactly how you would go about it. I have a few ideas which I won't share with the enemy, but imagine not being allowed to advance evidence and to say, well, I believed it was true for these reasons. Now, in the Anglo-Saxon system, truth is a defense. In fact, in traditional European justice, although we might come at it through slightly different means, truth is very important. That's the reason, of course, witnesses are required to swear to tell the truth, because it's important. When I found out after several experiences that the truth was not a defense of the Canadian Human Rights tribunal is looking into offenses in the now repealed Section 13 or internet censorship. I have one, in one case, and I was rather proud of myself because I was representing one of the victims. As a witness was about to be sworn in, I got up and objected to that. Well, what do you want, Mr. Brown? I object. What do you object to? I object to the witness being sworn in. Why? Well, if truth is no defense, who cares whether he lies or not? So why should he be required to tell, will you sit down and be quiet? Anyway, I thought it was actually a pretty good moment.
Orwellian, truth is no defense.
If truth is no defense, then who cares if he lies, if the witness lies?
Yeah.
I have to go, but it's been great being on the show, and maybe later on I can see some of the comments. And thanks to the people who listened, and try to take some actions on your own, or tell a friend, or tell somebody about this. Open up a discussion.
Yeah, great to have you on the show, Paul. You've got such a good memory, too. And you can be found at paulfromm.com, and your email is paul@paulfromm.com. For the viewers, please like and subscribe. Hit the bell for future updates and videos. And please donate to Brian Roos Show to keep the truth rolling on. So thanks for being on the show, Paul. Great to see you again.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
That was my discussion of Dresden, recorded on the Brian Roos Show. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'll take my my musical break right now, and I'm going to play a song here, which I hope you like. And this is Crazy Arms, an old Ray Price song, with Heather Miles. Thank you. Miles and Crazy Arms. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on lightresistanceradio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon, all those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf
Farmer. From Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven.